You are listening to Screenfish Radio. I'm your host, Steve Norton. John Wick Chapter 3 Parabellum reintroduces us to the fatally flawed titular hero who has been thrust out into the night due to his actions in the previous film. Desperate to find any form of shelter, he finds himself without allies as he attempts to escape with his life from the cutthroat streets of New York City. As always, Keanu Reeves' franchise delivers unbelievable stunt work and gun-fu, but it also wrestles with the dark night of his soul. This week on the show, authors Troy Kinney and Jason Norton return to grapple with Wick's choices and why we love him so much as a character. Welcome to the conversation. Welcome to Screenfish. Welcome to Screenfish Radio. We are so thrilled that you could be here this week as we talk about John Wick Chapter 3 Parabellum. And this week I'm thrilled to have back a couple of now Screenfish veterans, Jason Norton and Troy Kinney. Welcome back, guys.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to be here.
Well, I'm glad you guys could be here because, love him or hate him, John Wick is one of the more unexpected franchises, you might say, in the last 5 years. It seems to have come out of nowhere, but continues to garner better reviews and make more money at the box office. And in Chapter 3, we meet our hero again, who, after gunning down a member of the High Table, our legendary hitman John Wick finds himself stripped of the organization's protective services. Now stuck with a $14 million bounty on his head, Wick must fight his way through the streets of New York as he becomes the target of the world's most ruthless killers. As always, I want to remind our audience that this podcast is rated S for spoilers, in case you haven't seen the film. But let's be serious, if you're seeing the film, it's not for its story. Or maybe it is, anyway. But guys, I have to know what you think of John Wick Chapter 3 Parabellum.
Well, I thought it was fun. I really enjoyed it. I actually went and saw it with my dad, and especially those first 30 minutes or so, you could hardly catch a breath. That's how I felt.
Yeah, I thought it was really enjoyable. It's good action, but there's always kind of a catch your breath or take your breath away kind of action with it too. Being the hero and the protagonist, you know, like, he's probably going to survive the whole thing, but they make it all seem so edge of your seat, like it could go either way, that you really become invested in what you're watching, even with the fight scenes as crazy as they are. So, yeah, it's great fun from start to finish.
Well, I could be wrong, but I believe they are written and directed by his stunt guy from the Matrix films. I think Chad Stahelski and him go back into that. I think he's the stunt director from that trilogy, and that's where they started their relationship.
Mm.
But you guys are right. You know, it's interesting. I actually said that, turned to the friend that I saw the film with, and halfway through I went, you know, I'm not going to sleep for a week. And when he asked why, I said, because my adrenaline is pumping. Like, I don't think it's done in a film in a long time. It's just one nonstop, fully loaded rush, especially that first third. There is something, I would say too, I think there's something beautiful about the film, and it's so weird to say it because, I mean, these are violent films. Let's not forget, like, you're going there to watch him shoot people in the head. But there's something unique about it. What is it about this franchise that sets it apart from other ones?
Well, I think that what you're dealing with in some strange, this may be coming from left field or whatever, but there is a strange ballet or artistic choreography going on that really draws us in to what's happening with our character. And there's a story being told in the ballet. And obviously the ballet includes swords and guns and fists and kicks. but there's something about it that is it's astounding in some strange, interesting way. I think that's part of what's happening is we're watching a ballet of some sort, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think as they've progressed too, the films in the trilogy at this point, as they've progressed, the production has gotten a lot better. I mean, if you watch the first one as opposed to the third, stylistically, the sets, the lighting, kind of the ambiance of depending on which environment he's in, all of that kind of changes, and it creates kind of this pleasant palette of different tones and that sort of thing. So it kind of lends in almost to that cinematography with a ballet kind of a thing. But the other thing I think that is like from the character standpoint with the action that's always cool is the fights, although they're really technical, there's a little bit of sloppiness to some of the fighting. Like you can see him trying to block guys and it not going right, or you can see a guy punching him a certain way and it doesn't work out like they planned, and you see him really struggling to get that, you know, hip toss on a guy.
Yeah.
And so you can kind of identify with it. It's not like a clean, super choreographed, overly choreographed, like kung fu movie, you know? And so I think you can kind of identify with that. It puts you in his shoes of being in the struggle and in the fight. And he takes a beating. He's always taking a beating, you know?
Yeah, it's that character flaw that we need for us to be a part of it. It's funny because I was watching a little thing, and the director was talking about when he's battling the two guys, the ninjas, in the glass room.
And, oh, yeah.
There's a point where Keanu gets thrown through a glass thing, and he's sort of slipping to get up. He was saying that Keanu Reeves is really – he's actually slipping. But for us, we see character flaw in that. Like, he's worn out. Mm-hmm. They make that comment. Like, he's getting old and slow. And I think that brings us into his character a little bit and gives us, like, okay, you know, and he obviously has gotten shot. He's gotten stabbed. He's not impenetrable. But I think that helps us connect with his character.
You know, in some ways who he reminds me of is early Daniel Craig Bond.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like Casino Royale Daniel Craig, because I remember them saying that he was the Bond that bleeds, and that was sort of the tagline when he got there, because how many times, you know, you see now they've gotten more standard Bond in his action scenes. He's falling from trains and he's getting up and he's adjusting his cufflinks in his perfect suit. But I mean, I think you're right. I think, you know, there's something to be said for a guy who gets injured when he's fighting 100 guys. Or they're shooting at each other and he has to keep reloading, you know, like back in those 80s action films and 70s kung fu movies and all that stuff, that just never happened. They never really, you know, he might go, ugh, but he never bled. And, you know, people can correct me, I guess, if I'm wrong. But I mean, I just can't think of many instances where it, you know, you felt like there was some damage being done to this guy while he was inflicting it on others. You see it now more common, like Daredevil on Netflix that did that very, very well. But it is something unique, I think, to the style. I think Stahelski, too, so one thing, you guys were talking about it being a ballet. One thing I've picked up on is the first film, I mean, okay, there's an emotional points and stuff, but the first film is actually, to me, the most playful. Like, it's almost silly. His motivation isn't silly, but I mean, ultimately, they have to keep saying over and over again that he's killing because of this dog, right? You know, you killed his effing puppy, you know? And so,
I was talking about that to a guy I work with, because he had not even seen the second one yet. And we joked about, you know, the first film and that being the motivation. But it's not really – if you watch that film, the first one, it could just be a standalone, right? You could watch that and never have to see the rest, and it could be satisfactory, right? But once you get to three, you realize – how intense this guy's world is. This is every day for him. And, you know, if you cross that line with him, whatever the case may be, you realize, oh, it makes perfect sense that that's all it would take, and that's his motivation, and yeah. he comes back, and your whole family's toast, you know. It didn't really click with me, because I was the same way. I was like, oh my gosh, he's gunning down all these people because they killed his dog, you know.
Yeah.
But once I got to three, I was like, oh, I could totally see why he would come after you for that, you know.
Yeah, and they've played it up well. But see, this is one of the things I've seen is with each film, Stahelski's gotten more confident in his filming. Mm-hmm. And visually, he's gotten more thematic. So, you know, the second film, I might have the wrong film, so correct me if I'm wrong. But the opening of the second film opens with a shot from Modern Times, I believe. Because when he comes in, when the bike is coming down the street, there's a projection of like the old Charlie Chaplin film or whatever it is on the wall, right? It's establishing this is not going to be a heavy dialogue. We're going to show you something.
Interesting, yeah, because in this film, when he's walking through Times Square, there is also a Buster Keaton
yes.
projection on one of the screens as well.
Yes.
And it's interesting because if you look back at those old films, like you said, they're very physical, lots of physical things happening. It's very visual, not much dialogue, and it's dependent upon that. So, yeah, interesting.
Yeah, and you said before you talked about it being a ballet. This one is very deliberately a ballet. Like, to me, he's moving from physical to dance.
Mm.
Because so much of this film takes place, and for some reason, Angelica Houston is, like, in charge of these ballet dancers. And we see – they sort of even have a scene where they – the hitmen are almost – they don't dance, but they come out through the dance. You know, there's
right. –
So yeah. he's and using the visuals in these ways to sort of spell out what he's doing, I think.
And the dancers themselves, I don't know if you noticed, but they have scars and bruises and cuts on them because of their what they're doing for their art. They're sacrificing themselves for that as well.
Yeah.
They're giving all they have. And we see wrestlers and all that. So that's very interesting, yeah.
And all of them marked with the same tattoos.
Mm-hmm.
They're all kind of branded into that lifestyle, you know, that choice.
Yeah, see, that's where I see – I think with each film, Stahelski knocks it up visually, not just the stunts because, you know, like I just – and I will say this about the stunt work too is that everybody always praised the Bourne movies for their stunt work. You know, oh, well, you know, the way they do their car chases, it all could happen, blah, blah, blah. But you couldn't – I never felt like I could watch or enjoy a Bourne movie after the first one because of shaky cam.
Yeah.
And Stahelski isn't interested in shaky cam. He doesn't use it. Like we get to watch this play out.
Yeah.
That's why I just think they're beautiful films. It's so strange to say that about a film like this, but,
but it's interesting how he has you go to different visual places. The hotel being a big one, obviously, when we go meet Halle Berry in Casablanca, all of it's super, super visual. It's super interesting. So it's not just what's happening in the action, but I mean the whole mise-en-scene, I guess we could say, the whole setting, everything is part of what's happening.
Yeah.
And it's all – I think it's all kind of larger than life. You know, even when he's in the streets of New York and he's running through, you know, they take these big – they'll channel it down into the alleyway shot, but then they pan back out. And like you were saying earlier with Times Square, I mean, everything is just big and broad and bright. You know, even in the dark scenes, they've always got some kind of a light source somewhere that's really adding this kind of a aura to it, for lack of a better word, you know, where it's sure. kind of – it's got this energy about it. The whole thing has an energy. And I mean it's really modeled, you know, really after the Japanese revenge films that have been going on for a long time. But he's taken it and put this kind of art twist on it that we just haven't seen here. And it's made it so much of its own thing. You know, if you see a trailer for a John Wick movie now, you know what you're going to be getting. The thing that he's awesome at, that he's great with, is he gives you a little more tidbit each movie, you know, and it's not always you get the whole story or the whole backstory or the origin. You just get enough each time that you're like, oh, I want to keep watching. You know, I want to see the next one. So it's really well done in that regard, I think. Those breadcrumbs.
Yeah, they don't talk down to their audience. Like even in this one with the Halle Berry thing, he's like, you know that he did something. You know, we now know that he helped get her daughter out. But we don't – like they could tell you that story again and it would still be fresh. They don't say, well, you know, let's flash back to 2007 when – you know, it's like, yeah, okay, this is what you need to know and let's keep moving.
Yep. Yeah. And I know we sort of talked outside of this, but some of the homage – the homage that I was talking about earlier is they weave those in there too. And I feel that those are breadcrumbs as well. As they throw in a scene from Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, or a scene from Game of Death, or even from the old Matrix movies, we see these little pieces, and for me, I get excited when I see that too. So I'm like, I got the visuals, I got the action, I got these little pieces from the past thrown in there. I don't know, it was like a buffet for me. I was super excited to be in there and watching that thing.
I feel like, again, going back to Stahelski in this one, I feel like he really honors the past, and I don't mean in the story, but like he modernizes so much of what we saw. For crying out loud, they're using old school guns in this film, and he's retrofitting them. Like he's riding a horse, man. Mm-mm. Like
the horse scenes were great.
I think, you know, of all the fights in this one, as crazy as they get and crazier as it progresses, I think my favorite still is the opening scene in the library when he breaks a guy's neck over a book.
Oh.
That is just, I mean, I was like, well, there's an option I hadn't considered. you watch a John Wick movie and then you come away and you're sitting in your kitchen or your living room and you're like, okay, if it all breaks out, what can I pick up? You know, what do I grab first?
Well, you know,
good influence or bad influence, I don't know, maybe practically a good influence.
Yeah.
But, you know, probably not the best discussion for Screenfish, but we'll talk about that part afterward.
Well, you know what I thought in that scene is I thought this is so interesting to me about Wick, because if this were a Bond film, let's say it's Pierce Brosnan Bond. Bond has that fight scene in the library and he says, oh, there's nothing quite like a good book, or something like that, some cheesy line.
Yeah, there's no little quips like that, yeah.
Yeah, no, John Wick just, he does these things and he looks at them and he's like, oh, and then he leaves. It's like, you know what? Good for you, John Wick. We don't need the quip. No quips.
Yeah.
Marvel has to quip. Marvel always does that. We don't need those.
Yeah. But they do put humor in. The humor, yeah. I think, is super great, especially when they're in like the antique weaponry room. And they're fighting with their hands. They've run out of bullets. And they realize that next to them are a bunch of knives. And they're like, wait a minute, there's knives here. And they don't have to say anything. Nobody says anything. We see it on the look of their face. And they break in those cabinets and they start throwing knives at each other. I mean, I was losing it. I thought that was hilarious.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, we should remind our fans and any listeners that we are not sociopaths. And
well, maybe one of the three, and now you get to guess which.
By the way, Troy and Jason both have books, and we can talk. No. I was saying this before you came on, Troy. I was saying to Jason, I'm like, it is so strange to be like talking about a film as violent as this as a thing of beauty.
It is violent. I'm trying to, because people are going to be like, well, how you defend watching such a violent movie and those kinds of things. I think that's an interesting question that people pose. I don't know. I don't always know how to answer that question. I don't know what you guys think.
It's just escapism, right? That it's not like I'm going to walk out after I watch that and, you know, try to emulate any of that.
Sure.
It is so over the top, and I don't want to discredit any of it to seem like it's demeaning toward the film, because I think the film is great, but it almost is ludicrous with the violence, that to the point that it's like, this just could not happen. Right. Mm-hmm. It is so over the top that you get sucked into the world so well. They pull you in. I mean, from the first film, you know, like within 15, 20 minutes, okay, this is how it's going to be. And it's going to keep getting more mm-hmm. and more this way. Mm-hmm. But it's almost like you, and this may be why, you know, Wick is so endearing a character. You're right there with him in the trenches through all of it. And it's like, well, we know now. We accept that this is what life is going to be like, not only for him, but for us for the next 2 hours, 2 hours and 20 minutes. Let's go along for the ride and see where the chips fall, really. Because the crazy thing about the – I'm sitting in the theater watching this by myself, and it was a fairly bare bones showing when I went. I went to a late show, and there were only like 8 or 9 people in the theater. Uh-huh. But as the violence, you know, goes, I mean, some of it is almost comical as it just continues to escalate, and you can hear people, and I did it too. I would be laughing as I'm like, oh yeah. My gosh, I cannot believe he just pulled that off, you know? And so there's so much of this suspension of disbelief with it, because it is so over the top that you just kind of take it for what it is. And I don't know. You just don't. I feel like we get way too hung up on, you know, coming down on one side or another. It's art, you know. It's art. Just appreciate it for what it is on screen, and you know, psychoanalyze me later. You know, if I go off the deep end and do something I shouldn't. But you know,
well,
I agree. We're adults. We shouldn't be, you know, like influence to the point that we turn into John Wick. But
yeah, I agree with you. But even in the stories of our past and stories that have longevity, if you think about like a Beowulf that's filled with violence, you think about a King Arthur legend story filled with all kinds of fighting and violence, I think that there is a picture of, and I get literary, I get a little figurative in my thinking, but I think that there is a little picture of our reality. And I mean, if we look at John Wick in that way, our lives are filled with things coming at us all the time that we have to defend ourselves against, defend our family against. We may not have knives and swords and guns, but there are things coming at us, political things, social things, whatever it is. And in a sense, I mean, if I want to look at it figuratively, it makes all kinds of sense. I mean, that might be a little far for some people, but sometimes I think that that's actually what's being pictured, is some of that is happening too. So mm-hmm. I just throw that out there as a little bit of fodder for you.
You know, I think you're right. And I think it's funny because in a case like this, like I've seen movies that are violent that have really bothered me.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like so much of this film is about character. And, you know, like there, and I compare it to two other things. I think of all of these action heroes the last few years, but I link this to Taken. In some ways, I see this franchise as Liam Neeson's fault, because when Taken broke out, it became the model of so many franchises of, here's a guy who's in his, you know, early 50s or early 60s. You know, let's go back to the Charles Bronson, you know, Death Wish type model of film. And all of a sudden you had all these copycats. But John Wick is the one that stuck.
Mm-hmm.
And the other interesting thing I would compare it to is 24. This is a very Jack Bauer-esque character for me. And everybody always liked the scenes where Jack Bauer went nuts. But that's not why you tuned in. You tuned in because you were in love with Jack Bauer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they tried to reboot it with another guy, and it didn't work. And Kiefer was like, oh, you know, I'm not the star of the show. It's the clock, and it's the concept, and then this other guy. And it totally bombed. And the reason was people are in love with his character. And yeah. I think that the Wick character is like this.
Yeah, a few franchises have been able to breach character, right? Doctor Who breaches character. James Bond breaches character. We get different people playing those people, but sometimes you just have to have that guy that plays that character.
Yeah, I don't want to see, you know, Kevin Costner play John Wick. I want Keanu flipping Reeves to play. But what is it?
It's funny for me because I've never been a big Keanu Reeves fan, right? Like, I've never thought any of his other action stuff that he really pulled off well. Like, I go ahead and skewer me, but I was not a fan of the Matrix movies because I just felt he was a little stiff, right? Yeah. And in this, there's stiffness and he doesn't, you know, there's not a ton of dialogue, but there's something about him and the physicality of it and having just enough of this backstory where you can connect the dots knowing that, hey, this guy had this huge loss emotionally. You know, he's basically tied into this organization that he's doing everything he can to get out of. He doesn't want to be in this life anymore. Something about all of that just adds this kind of a nuance where you're invested into it early on. You know, you kind of what Troy was saying about being bombarded with all this stuff all day long. You can sympathize and empathize, even if, you know, you're not going to be doing what he does, but it just helps to tie you to the character a little bit more. And, you know, some of these other ones that they've tried in the past, the recent past, they were just pretty one-dimensional. They didn't have that sort of extra layer.
Yeah, you know, there's a line in this film which I think sums it up, because I really do think it's about Keanu Reeves as Wick. And it's when he's in Grand Central Station and he's walking up and he comes to the primary guy, right? The primary hitman guy. And they're walking towards each other and you think they're going to rumble, and this group of kids walks in between them. And he stops and the guy looks at him and he says, that's why you're special, John Wick. I wouldn't have stopped. So right. We know he's vicious, like he can be vicious, but at the same time, in some ways he is the broken puppy. You know, like you want to, like he killed because of the dog, but dogs are becoming an increasing theme in this movie, especially in the third one. Like, not only are there more dogs, they're talking, don't they even talk about Canis Minor at one point? You have to follow the dog and all this stuff. It was like, so dogs are a thing in this world. Okay. But to me, it's really about the fact that here is a guy who isn't killing because he wants to. He's killing because he has to in some respects. At first, it's just about, man, you screwed over this guy in the early film. In the first film, in the first part of the second film, it's like, man, I just want my dog and my car back. Just leave me alone.
But I would love to know, like, if they made that first one with ever having any intention of expanding upon it. And if it just took off so much that they were like, okay, well, now we've got something we can, you know, develop.
I feel the same way. Cause I remember when the first one came out, and I'm not a huge Keanu Reeves guy either. I did like the first two Matrix movies, but people are like, oh, John Wick came out and it's pretty good. And I'm like, is it really? And then I waited till it came out on DVD or streaming or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. And I was like, and by the time it came out, 2 was right on its heels. And so I saw 1 and I was like, wow, that's pretty good. And then, man, I went right out and saw 2. And then when 3 came, well, I was chomping at the bit to go see 3. So they've done something great with this franchise. They've really pushed it. But I think you said it earlier, it came out of nowhere.
The second one is really the one with the story that grabbed me. I thought the first one was kind of fun.
Yes.
Like,
I agree.
Like Batman Begins. Like, hey, this was all right. I enjoyed this.
It's sort of, you know, and don't let this be sacrilege, but it's sort of comparative to the original Star Wars, right? Because you could have had Star Wars, A New Hope, and ended it right there.
Yeah.
Yep.
But you end up with that second film that really, you know, we look back now, everybody considers Empire to be the best. This is kind of how this is going, although I think 3 is really good too. But if you did not have that second film in there with the story hooking you like it did, again, I don't know if they would have come away with enough response to make a third, you know. So it's kind of fallen in line with some of that, you know, lineage with the way Star Wars was. It's kind of how I felt when I came out of seeing this third one.
Yeah, I agree. I would say there are three franchises I think of when I think of that sort of structure. It's the Dark Knight trilogy, It's the Star Wars trilogy, and the new Planet of the Apes trilogy. Every one of those, I thought, hey, that first one was pretty good. I enjoyed that. That was fun. I'd like another one. And in all three of those things, the second one kicked it up a notch, and they all sort of carried it into the third in different ways. Like Return of the Jedi didn't do it in the same level as Empires did. Neither did the other three. But I think this was a solid third. I enjoyed it.
Oh yeah.
I agree.
One of the things I wanted to ask you guys about this, though, because this is the other thing I like these films. There's so much imagery and conversation. Like, I remember the second film, I just thought it was actually a very profound film in a number of ways. Like, in some ways, I think it's a profound character piece disguised under violence. And this one has some really interesting stuff. Like, I was wondering what you thought about the idea of how – what it means to be bound to service in this film. Because it's sort of – I mean, the second one sort of deals with – you know, almost the brother against brother aspect with him and the other hitman who hires him back and forth. But the third film really has him dealing with the head table in a lot of ways. And he repeatedly says things, or the phrase enters for the first time in the series, "I have served, I will be of service."
Uh-huh.
I just wondered what you guys thought of that and what you thought about that sort of relationship that's going on.
Yeah, I thought it was a neat dynamic of bringing in, like, again, as we start to see more and more of his origin. And so you find out that they even call him, you know, they call him by his Russian nickname, the boogeyman thing. They reference that back a lot several times in this. But anyway, that he's been tied to this for a lot longer than we know about, right? If you kind of take the hints and inferences, it seems like almost he's been raised like from a child in this lifestyle, kind of like they did with Black Widow in the Avengers films. And so, you know, he's brought up in this kind of caste system, I guess, for lack of better words, this hierarchy of we start you low and we train you up, but you know your role, and then we give you a little bit more and you still know your role and you're subservient to this and subservient to that. And so it's like in all phases of his life, he's always been working to be better, but he's always been in service to the higher power. In this case, you know, his assassin family, for lack of better words. And so it's like he's raised with this mentality of knowing that, yes, I have these abilities nobody else has, but that still does not diminish my overall purpose for the higher power, you know. And so it's kind of a humility thing that he carries with him, this strange code, you know. I mean, he can walk into a room and wipe out half of everybody there, but then yet and still, he's still subservient to those above him. It's kind of an interesting weight that he carries on his shoulders. You know, he's got these big tattoos that hang on his shoulders, and he's still kind of carrying the same weight around by being tied to this, you know, family, for lack of a better word. So it's kind of an interesting dynamic.
Yeah, and the Angelica Houston scenario, I think, gives us a picture of his past. I think we're sort of walking through him growing up. We see these young boys. These are the people that have trained him, and he owes them his service because he was disciplined by them, if that makes sense as well. So, you know, and they made these comments. Do you remember that? Remember doing this? Mm. And you hear that as you go through, and we're sort of, again, they don't talk down to us. We don't have to have a memory or a slideshow of his past. We're seeing pictures of these young people being brought up in a discipline that they're going to owe a service to as well. And so I think that we get that when he walks through those rooms to see Angelica Houston.
It's almost reminiscent of like Spartan history, how they would raise the kids, you know. Mm-hmm. They would raise them in this real violent type of school, you know, pretty much for their whole life. And then when they finish, you know, yes, they're these strong warriors, but they have this bigger allegiance, this bigger debt, if you will, to the state or the city state. And in this case, you know, John Wick's city state is this Assassin's Guild. So it's kind of a similar pathway.
Sure.
I like how they've sort of set up this contrast between the High Table and the Continental, you know, because like the High Table, and, you know, like you say, they talk about him being trained. I thought it was really interesting. There's some interesting dialogue about the relationship they have. And the High Table I see is almost like this evil, omnipotent, all-powerful sort of being. It was interesting. At one point, I think it's Angelica Houston, says, "How can you escape from the light? Of course, you can go to the dark, but they're in the dark too." That might have been Winston. I could be wrong on that.
I think you might be right, actually. I think that's what she says, just like that.
And you know what I thought of? I thought of Psalm 139.
Okay.
I'm sitting there and I'm like, holy crap, this is like the reverse of Psalm 39. It's like, where can I go to the depths? You know, I make my bed in the depths of Sheol and you're there. You know, I climb to the highest heights and you are there. And I'm like, my gosh, these guys are everywhere.
Yeah.
And even the type of relationship they have, it comes up a few times. I think don't they describe assassin as men who are faithful and abide by their beliefs? I've never right. viewed assassins in that way before. You know, assassins are people that kill. That's what they do. But they put this aspect of, no, they're doing what we tell them to do. But yet at the same time, they've got this idea of choice. Like Wick's commits himself to service. And, you know, Jason, you mentioned about the consequences of choice in our chat before. And Wick sort of has this opportunity. He goes and visits Winston, and they have ordered him to kill. And Winston has he still has the chance to pull the trigger. And Winston puts it right to him. Who do you wish to die as? The Baba Yaga?
Yeah.
Or as a man who loved and was loved by his wife? Like,
right.
There's some fascinating dialogue about that. This idea of choice shows up in the film.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's super interesting. I just looked up Psalm 39 real quick, and there's some interesting phrases in there. Surely everyone around is like a mere phantom. In vain they rush about heaping up wealth without knowing whose it will finally be. I think that happens in the movie. I think that's interesting, looking at some of this stuff, what's happening here. And I think directors do stuff like, I think Quentin Tarantino does that all the time. I think they pull Bible verses and they throw stuff in there. Anyway.
One of the things I've seen in the last two films especially is there's huge conversation about the soul. There's actually that final battle in the last film, if you remember, in the second film, the final battle is in this art museum. And I think it's actually called The Journey into the Soul.
Mm.
And there's fire in the background, and then there's bright white lights in the background, and he's sort of like got these two things visually going on. And I really think that Stahelski plays with this idea of the Continental as being sort of Edenic in some ways. Because no matter who you are, when you come into the Continental, this had better be a safe haven for you. You know, his life is saved by tapping the stairwell, for crying out loud.
Right.
But I don't know. Jason, you brought up the idea of choice. What do you think?
Yeah, the thing about it, I mean, as much as they talk about it in, you know, it's even emblazoned on the actual movie posters, some of the variant movie posters for this one anyway, about, you know, the choice aspect. While I was thinking about that, unique to this film, I couldn't help but keep thinking back to the very first one. You know, he had a choice in that very first one, when the Russian guys first see him at the gas pumps, you know, and he could have wiped him out right there, right? For, you know, even just messing with his car and threatening him and all that sort of stuff. But he chose not to. And by choosing not to, it led to all of this other stuff. Was he a better man for not, you know, killing them right there at the gas pumps? Or was he a better man for letting them live? And then all of this, you know, has happened in the aftermath. And so as much of, you know, it leans on the choices that he's made specific to film three, or as much as they want to emphasize, you know, the choices in film three, you kind of start piecing back and you think, well, but if he'd have done one thing differently, you know, how would it have changed the rest of the movies, the rest of the franchise, whatever, if the filmmakers had chosen to go? Because one thing that I found very, very interesting, and I think Steve and I think we talked about this long before when we first decided that I was going to come on to do this podcast. The filmmakers originally, and this is stuff I've seen on YouTube from other fact-based shows, they did not want to kill the dog.
Yeah.
The filmmakers in the first film were like, no, we can't kill the dog. You're crazy. And then, you know, some of the other people invested in the movie were like, you have to kill the dog, because if you don't, it's not going to have the same ramifications. You know, you won't be invested as a viewer and have the same passion for what he's about to do as he does. And so even with that, you know, if they had chosen not to kill the dog, would anybody have been as enthused about, you know, everything that played the next 90 minutes of that movie? You know, would it have been as popular as it was? But, you know, and just, you just extract it and look at life, you know, you're faced with what you think is either a big decision or a minor decision. It's how you react that, you know, plays out what the fate is going to be. I just thought it was an interesting take that they chose to really hammer on that in this one, with all the stuff they could have pulled out, you know, the choice aspect, which is pretty cool. It's not something you see in heavy duty action movies.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't like expound upon it a lot. I mean, they just kind of put one or two phrases out there and then you're left to kind of wrestle with it yourself, which is kind of cool. So,
yeah, it seems like they respect the intelligence of the audience watching it, or at least those that care to be involved on that level.
Right.
This is the funny thing about a film like this is that, I mean, visually, it's a highly visual film, obviously, but the conversations they have in some ways are far more complex than John Wick running around throwing knives in a knife shop. Like, I think that's one of the things I like about the film. You know, like, he's such a fascinating type of character. I just don't want these movies to get lame. Like, I don't want there to be a point where we're like, okay, I guess we have to watch another John Wick. They're asking some interesting questions and bringing out some really fascinating imagery that I think can be pretty deep.
I agree with that. And I think that that's kind of what ruined the third Matrix movie, is there was so much of them trying to explain to us what they were trying to say and what they were trying to do. I like the fact that things are hidden and we don't know. I think it keeps it interesting. I like this educator that they brought in. Is that how you say the word? All of a sudden there's a plot going on beside the plot that's happening. She's running around talking to these people that have helped John Wick while he's trying to battle his thing. I think that adds to the richness of our story. New characters coming in, doing different, interesting things. I like that aspect of the educator. Is that how you say the name?
Adjudicator?
I'm not sure. Adjudicator, that's it.
Yeah, that's it.
As of the educator? No, I really like the Continental now. Like, the Continental to me is such an Edenic place. And I think I said that before, that they're fighting to preserve the aspect of it, that there's something safe there, which is why I wasn't 100% sold on the ending, because I wasn't entirely sure what they were going for. I want to watch it again. And sort of work with that. But I mean, the first film.
Which part are you talking about? Are you talking about when
Winston shoots him off the side of the building?
He falls off the building?
Yeah. Yeah. But okay. I see, my whole thing was, did John know that he was going to do that? Because he didn't, or like, was that the plan all along? Or did he just do it at random? Like, he doesn't seem to know.
It seems like they would have worked. Plan because he only shoots him In his bulletproof section. He never shoots him otherwhere, in any other place. And I felt like a little bit like it was, and I think that the educator, is that,
Adjudicator.
Adjudicator. I think that she sort of felt like, wait a minute, there seems to be something going on here. And I'm also intrigued by the Bowery King, right? I mean, we have this other guy. We don't really know what's going on there. And I like the little bit of mystery. I don't need somebody to come in and go, okay, this is who so-and-so is, and this is why they exist and what they do. I don't need all that. I like having a little bit of mystery. It creates an intrigue for me.
Wasn't there a small part of you guys when the Bowery King is there and John Wick's on the floor that you didn't want him to offer him two types of medication, one a red pill and one a blue pill?
Yeah, I did find that pretty ironic. I thought that was pretty cool. And like I said, I'm not a Matrix guy, but I thought that was pretty cool.
You know what? I feel like he could do that at this point, and I feel like we would just accept it and be happy. They redeemed Halle Berry for me, so I'm okay with it. Like, how did that happen?
Something came to my mind. I'm kind of looking at the posters here online. And I noticed that some of the posters, they seem to have a halo around his head.
Really?
For John Wick 3. He has this sort of blue halo or a halo around his head. So that makes me start wondering if maybe he's some sort of avenging angel, maybe some biblical character in that realm, or a character of religious significance. That's part of what they do. I don't know if that's something you guys would be interested in pursuing.
That's interesting. I agree with you. I tell you, there's something about this series that wants to talk about the battle for the soul.
Mm.
I really believe that. For crying out loud, what's his ticket out of town? It's a cross. It's a crucifix.
Yeah, that's what I thought of when I saw that too.
And there's something about the fact that he loves his wife. I thought that was very interesting that he tells the high table. I mean, that's the whole... That's why he uses the ticket to get to that guy. So the ticket is the cross. He gets to that guy. Why do you want to stay alive? And what was his answer? To remember and the love that I have for my wife. That's fairly significant and interesting, right? I mean,
yeah.
How do we handle that?
Yeah, yeah. His relationship to survival is spurred on by love. You know,
mm-hmm.
Winston says that, you know, do you want to be remembered as the Baba, or why do you wish, yes. Who do you wish to die as, the Baba Yaga or as a man who loved and was loved by his wife?
Yeah.
Like that is meaningful. Okay. The freedom he's looking for in this movie could be just about John wanting to live, but it doesn't seem, there seems to be some desire not to live without love.
Right.
To me. Now, it's not like he's looking for a relationship. Like you said, it's about remembering that. It's fascinating.
Yeah, it's funny because as films progress, every like little piece of him keeps getting cut away, right? So
yeah.
he loses his dog, obviously, and then his house gets blown up with his memories, and then, you know, his cell phone that he'd been watching his wife, you know, like we assume the last video he had of his wife was on his phone, that gets busted and torn away. And then in this point, you lose a little bit more. He loses a little bit more of the things that tied him to, you know, the life he wanted to have. It keeps getting chipped away little by little, little by little, a little bit more. But yet and still, above all of that, the actual just memory, the nostalgia, I guess, for what he had, he's still holding on to that beyond everything else. And so they really are breaking him down to the point that there's pretty soon there's not going to be anything left but his soul, right?
Yeah.
He's not going to have anything physical to tie into what he did have before. And so it's going to be just, you know, with every fight he gets beaten up and busted up more, with everything that happens to him psychologically, he's losing a little bit more of, you know, holding on, but yet still he keeps holding on. And that's kind of, again, I think, and we've talked about it a lot, but that's an endearing quality about him. You know, you can keep, he keeps fighting, he keeps getting up. He's kind of like the Rocky of hitmen, you know? And that just makes it so much more real, I guess.
So I just I'm having another one of those crazy moments. And so when Ian McShane, what's his name in the
Winston
asks him that question that you've brought up a couple times now about whether he wants to be Baba Yaga or if he wants to be the man that was loved by his wife and he loves, that brought weird things, but it brought Moulin Rouge to my mind. And one of the things they say in that movie is the greatest thing you'll ever learn is to be loved and love in return, which is actually it's a line from a Nat King Cole song called Nature Boy. And it's just interesting that seems to be part of what John Wick is working on, is this idea of love and being just to love and love in return. It's almost the same phrase as serve and willing to serve. It's that yeah, same sort of phraseology that we're going for is serve and love. I wonder if we're seeing a parallel there.
Well, and you know, and about that scene too, and this is why I love the imagery of the Continental. I'm just so fascinated by Winston in this Continental. When he, again, visually, when he approaches Winston, keep in mind he's come out of the depths, right? He's literally come out of the depths, and he ascends to Winston to this brightly lit white screen, and there's this bright screen behind Winston of these it's almost clouds. You get the sense that Winston is giving him this choice, like almost godlike ascension. Again, coming, you know, using that visual imagery of the soul. And as they're having this conversation, like there, Winston reminds him that you have the choice to do, you've committed your service to the devil, if you will, because you're now back with the high table, but you don't have to be. You can choose to be free, but freedom is about this recognition of love. And that's what's most important. And, you know, you talk about him getting stripped away to the very what's left is his soul. I think what you see is so much in the last two films especially is this battle fighting for control of John Wick's soul. You know, you talk about him being an avenging angel. I think that there is a real fight. How do you save John Wick? And going back to what we were saying before, I think that's why we love him. It's because we see that John Wick can be saved, but he doesn't know how.
And he has pieces of humanity, and he has some faults in himself. I mean, you mentioned it earlier with the kids. He understands that the bad guys are the bad guys, and other people are not part of this.
Yeah.
And that's very important to him. He holds that in high regard. Even when he doesn't do away with the ninja guys, he withholds from them his wrath.
This seems like a good place for us to start wrapping up, guys. Before we do that, one final question. Favorite thing that happens in the film? Favorite stunt, favorite moment? Go.
I got to narrow it down to one?
Yeah, oh, one. Oh, your favorite.
I already said mine. The breakneck book kill. If I'm ever in a library and I get attacked by a 7-foot assassin, I'm going to try that.
The horse kick, really.
Two of them, no less. Neither was that guy.
He slaps that horse, and I was like, what the heck just happened? I sort of felt like there's a bunch of guys sitting around a room going, okay, we've already done this, and we've already done that. What can we do with some horses?
Guys.
Oh, when that happened, my dad and I were both like, what the heck is going on?
Oh, I know. I know. We've missed what to me is still one of the most impressive stunts in the whole film is the dog jumping up a 12 to 15 foot wall in one leap.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
I was like, what the heck just happened? And can we get that from three different angles, you know, like in the Taken movies for these lame stunts? Because I want to see that one happen again. Because it was very clearly one take. Like, this was not like, oh, let's cut him jumping, and oh, there he's on the wall. Like, this was one take. That dog went 12 feet in the air. I was like, holy cow. Guys, I mean, we gotta do this. So let's screen it or skip it. John Wick 3 Parabellum, screen it or skip it.
I screen it for sure.
Absolutely.
A lot of fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's, I think this definitely is one to be seen in the theater, not to wait till it comes out. It's a good big screen film for sure.
Yes, definitely. I agree with that totally.
Yeah, I mean, it's a movie you can bring your small children to. And no.
Yep.
You want your kids to learn about the world. No, I'm kidding.
Your anti-gun friends, get those to come along.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Your anti-axe friends, your anti-knife friends, anti-crotch-eating dog friends.
Oh, my gosh.
A lot of that goes on.
What concerns me is that you have friends that aren't anti-crotch-eating dogs. Honestly, obviously I'm kidding, but I mean this, I just thought this film was so visually stunning. I am not a guy who says, wow, this movie's crazy violent, you got to go see it. I'm not that guy.
Right.
That's not my style, but there's something about this franchise that actually just makes me want to, you know, cheer in the theater. And it's just, there's just so much fun in the crazy. This is a screen it for me, for sure.
Yeah.
Thank you guys so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. You can hawk your books. Do you want to hawk your books?
Sure.
Go ahead, Troy. You start with you.
Yeah, I got a book out. It's on Amazon. Watching Movies, Watching Stories. It's available on Amazon in both Kindle version and paperback. So go check it out. My website is www.troykinney.com. That's TROYKINNEY.com. I got some blog stuff, some articles, some essays on there, some other movie reviews. So check it out. I'd love it.
Very good. Thanks. Jason, you want to pump your stuff?
Sure, I'm always up for a free plug. my book is called The Sons of Solomon and the Beast Men of Scepter. It is a throwback to old pulp fiction superhero type stories, a little bit of Indiana Jones' action adventure kind of thing with some magic and monsters thrown in. It's available on Amazon, also from Prose Press, PROSEPRESS. That is volume one of a series. Volume two is awaiting publication as we speak, and I'm working on volume three now. So,
great. All right. Thank you, guys. It's love having you on. I really appreciate it. For you at home, a reminder that you can catch us anywhere that podcasts are available pretty well. Google Play, Spotify, Apple Podcasts. You can listen to us on your Alexa via Stitcher. If you go to the podcast page on our website, screenfish.net, you can download Fishing for More, questions that you can have to start the conversation where you are with the people that you see the film with as well. So, guys, thank you so much again for coming on. I really appreciate it. And for all of you at home, we started the conversation. This was Screenfish.